Then for tomorrow, more sunshine, dry weather, if anything, a little warmer, expecting a high around 80. And that's where our highs will sit for the following 2 days. Looking ahead, the next chance for some rain coming up Thursday night, when showers and storms, at this point in time at least, are considered likely. Cooling off for the weekend, with temperatures falling back into the 70s. The normal high for this time of year is 72. The record high for this date is 98. That mark set in 1939. The sun will set this evening at 7:04. It'll rise tomorrow morning at 6:31. At 8 o'clock, sunshine reported throughout the area, 58 degrees in Kenosha, 53 in Lake Geneva. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and we are certainly beginning this week of morning shows in exciting fashion. I am so happy to be welcoming into our studios for the first time Herman Moshaba, who is a very, very successful and important entrepreneur in South Africa, and also one of its most important philanthropists and civic leaders. Herman Moshaba, back in the 1980s, founded a hair care company called Black Like Me. And this company came along at just the right time, although it also came during a very challenging time in South Africa's history as well. But it skyrocketed in its success, and Herman Moshaba has overcome many, many obstacles to achieve this tremendous success. He is, among other things, a real champion of human freedom, and particularly the freedom afforded by capitalism, and is very concerned about some of the new political trends in the nation of South Africa. Many people seeming to pull away from all the promise that capitalism, free markets, can extend to ordinary people, and has written extensively on the topic, spoken extensively on the topic. His most recent book, called Capitalist Crusader, Fighting Poverty Through Economic Growth, which he hopes will be a rallying cry for his countrymen as they try to contend with some very worrisome new trends politically and economically. Herman Mashaba is on the campus of Carthage College today and speaking up in Milwaukee tonight. But we are so happy to have him here in our studios, along with Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center. Dr. Sear is helping to host Mr. Mashaba during his visit at Carthage. Dr. Sear, of course, we see on a very regular basis, and we'll see him in a couple of weeks for his monthly visit to the program. So we welcome you back, Dr. Sear, and Herman Mashaba, welcome to WGTD.
What a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for this invitation and really be given an opportunity to engage with your listeners.
Great to have you here. Thank you so much. Thank Professor Sear, explain Herman Mashaba's connection to Carthage, how this invitation was extended, and how we finally get to have Mr. Mashaba on the morning show after an initial attempt that Mother Nature sort of interrupted.
Well, we can thank another great friend and champion of capitalism and freedom, our colleague Yuri Maltsev in the economics department, who has taken several Carthage student, faculty, and community groups to South Africa. We'll be taking another group early next year, and that's really the connection with Mr. Mashaba through Professor Maltsev.
And maybe you could explain, Mr. Mashaba, how you first met Yuri Maltsev.
Well, I think I met Yuri a few years ago in one of the trips with the students in South Africa. And for 3 years in South Africa, I was the chairman of the Free Market Foundation. And during my tenure as the chairman of the Free Market Foundation in South Africa, we conceived an idea of what we called Luminary Awards, where we identified individuals in South Africa and globally that we felt really represented what we free marketers in South Africa stand for. And what happened is Yuri became our first recipient of this award. And we invited him to South Africa to receive this award. And since then, he's really been really very close and a friend of our organization in South Africa. It's really, really one of those luminaries and world global leaders that I think we so much respect.
Very good. Mm. So you were supposed to be here on the morning show, was it about a year ago?
No, it's about February this year.
Oh, that makes sense.
February this year. To came over when I came into the United States, I landed in Boston because I had my wife attending classes there. So I flew in with her on a Saturday, and the plan was to really leave to Boston on Monday morning because my public lecture here at Carthage was on Monday evening. Unfortunately, the weather just could not allow me. Sunday started getting some massive snow in Boston, and the flights were cancelled on Monday. Managed to really be on Tuesday. I was really quite devastated. And I would really made a promise to Yuri that as soon as I get home, I'll look at my diary and advise him to really to come back, because I really felt disappointed that I must have really let people down. And fortunate enough, when I got home, I managed to look at my diary and contacted Yuri and the university. And they were happy to really welcome me back. And here am I, so got to GF safely on Saturday.
No blizzards this time. Well, we're so glad that you're here, safe and sound. We should sketch for our listeners the really interesting life that you have lived. You told us before we went on the air that you were born in 1959. Mm. And I want you to describe to our listeners, generally speaking at least, what life was like in South Africa back in 1959, kind of an old South Africa that most people only know, in a sense, in history books, but it's an important legacy that should not be forgotten.
Well, absolutely. I think it's actually quite interesting. And actually, that's what my lecture is all about, talking about the economic freedoms of South Africa, the contradictions. And really what I do here, take the students and the listeners through a journey of my life, born in August 1959, a year after South Africa was taken over by Prime Minister H.F. Verwoerd, who is well known worldwide as as the architect of apartheid.
Architect of apartheid,
Dr. H.F. Verwoerd. I mean, this man was just really one of those crazy leaders, but obviously very popular with the National Party government. And what's quite interesting about the National Party, 9 years before I was born in 1950, passed the piece of legislation called the Suppression of Communism Act of 1950. This piece of legislation declared anyone who fought or advocated for human rights for black people was automatically declared a communist. So by virtue of that, I think I keep telling people that when I was born in 1959, by law, I was a communist.
Wow.
which was really very strange. And as I was growing up, really despite to communism and really wanted my freedom. And the United States and the Western world in particular, it was the area that really always appealed to me, looking at the individual freedom that really people enjoyed in the Western world. But unfortunately, by the virtue of that piece of legislation, I happened to really be declared a communist. But I defied all that, and really brought up by my mother. I lost my father at the age of 2 to my mother, who had no real commercial skill except cleaning white homes and working as a domestic worker in Johannesburg. I was born in a small village, 30 k's out of Pretoria. So my mother used to, when I actually started seeing what was happening in my life, I had no parents around, brought up by my older sisters. My mother used to come home once a month to you know, come and see us. So really, I tell the world I was brought up by nature. You know, without any parental supervision. But fortunate enough, I survived, including actually going to university in 1979 and really committed myself to education, because I've always really longed, as I was growing up, to really be an independent person. And I thought education would really help to really give me that kind of freedom that I wanted.
Try to describe for us, if you would, what apartheid was like in terms of your daily life. I think a lot of Americans wonder how it would compare, for instance, with life in the South of the United States, where there was no exactly rigid system like apartheid in place, and yet the reality was of blacks and whites having very little or very limited interaction. But I suspect apartheid played out a little bit differently than that. What are the ways in which there was this sense of the two races being apart?
Well, I think there are lots of pieces of legislation that really separated South Africans, black and white. You know, the pass laws in particular, for me, I found it to really be a piece of legislation that was really quite evil and vicious. Because as black South Africans from the age of 16, you had to really carry your identity document with you 24 hours. And that restricted you to live in a particular, to live and work in a particular area. And we had the police really raiding, stopping you 24 hours. So this piece of legislation, any time after the age of 16, you've got to make sure that you have it. But then at the same time, you might just really have it and happen to really be in the wrong area, because this piece of legislation, piece of document restricted you to really only be within those confines. You know, that's really something that for me growing up, I really find really quite demeaning. Obviously, we had other pieces of legislation like Group Areas Act that the black people were not allowed to live in certain areas. We had our own designated townships and villages where you could really live. So state of emergency as I was growing up, from 1976 in particular, we had the Soweto riots in June 16, 1976. Since then, you know, South Africa really lived under state of emergency after the other, you know, which is really quite difficult because our areas were always cordoned off by the army. So, you know, movement in and out quite really difficult. But
growing up, how many whites would you, for instance, have personally known as a young person? Would you ever have a friend who was white? Would you ever even see a young person who was white?
Well, what's interesting, like I'm saying this in my book, that, you know, I grew up actually believing, and I thought white people were evil because I had no personal contact with them whatsoever. The only time, obviously, you go into the city center or you come across whites, generally, white people in South Africa were very violent. You know, always really causing problem for you as a black person. The police and any white person can just really create problems for you. So, you know, so and listening to people around me. So that's why when I was growing up, I thought white people were evil creatures. Mm. And the reason why in 1980, when I abandoned my education, wanted to go for military training and get the Russians to give me an AK-47, train me, and go back to South Africa, cause havoc with these evil creatures. Hmm. So there was absolutely no contact whatsoever. The contact that we had was obviously seeing them, seeing white people, and all the time causing problems most of the time. Hmm. You know, so that's really my experience of whites until I was in my early 20s when I started working. And really started interacting and obviously really discovered another world. It's still under apartheid in the early 80s, where I worked as a commission sales rep representing the companies obviously owned by white South Africans, and got to really interact and really discovered that the problem wasn't really with the people. The problem was with the government, with the political leadership. These are the people actually cruelly causing and creating this division amongst us South Africans. Mm. Human beings, you know.
I know that you mentioned already that it was drilled into you the importance of education to advance yourself, and you went off to college, but your college education was, as I recall, interrupted by some kind of political unrest, which in effect shut the college down.
Yeah.
And you, when ultimately the doors opened again, you weren't interested in going back. Is there any particular reason why you decided not to resume that education and kind of take another path?
Yeah, what happened in 1980, in my second year of my studies, to major, actually, I was doing a degree called B.Admin, majoring in political science and public administration. And I really was in love with political science in particular. When I was a student, I was, you know, all my peers knew that I was committed to in becoming a political scientist of note. Mm. And I wanted to really be a professor and leave the country, go and really study further or be a lecturer somewhere outside South Africa. Unfortunately for us, one morning in 1980, 6 o'clock in the morning, the university was surrounded by the army. The reason why the university was surrounded by the army, we were not attending classes for 2 weeks because some of our colleagues were arrested prior to that. Mm. And then as students, because at the time in South Africa, was, in the universities, we were not allowed to have a student representative council. They were banned by all the state of emergencies and so forth. But students at the university level, one day we decided, no, this is enough, so called them the mass meeting. And says we can't really go to classes when some of our colleagues are in jail and we don't know why they were arrested, and we want, we said to the administration, please negotiate with authorities to release our fellow students, and boycotted classes. And one morning, 6 o'clock, they decided to really call the army and decided to send us back home. We were given 6 hours to leave the university. And that, for me, a painful period of my life, because that became the end of my academic career overnight. Hmm. Because when about after a month or so, when they called us back, I decided I'm not going back. I was really very angry, realizing that, you know what, it looks like I'm really wasting my time to really be in this environment. So the best thing to really fast track my independence was to go for military training. You know, for us as young black youth at the time, it was our ambition to leave the country and go and fight, because that was the only way we could really see freedom. And what was actually quite strange about it is that at the time, the Russians were the only people who were openly supporting liberation movement in neighboring countries. giving us AK-47s and train and really come back. And that's really was my dream, to also leave, because I said, to going back to university, chances of really completing my education is going to be slim and you'll be arrested. So I said, no, let me really go out and really fast track our liberation. But then you needed very strong connections to take you out of the country. And I was really so lucky that that never really happened. if I look at it in retrospect now, that stayed in the country. And then that's when I got my first job, worked for 7 months, got my second job, worked for 23 months. But then 30 months into my life, I realized, Herman, you're no longer a young man. You're losing time and you've got only one chance in life. You've got to do something to attain your freedom. You're not going to be like your fathers, your family, people working for white companies for the rest of their lives. And 40 years, 50 years later, they've got absolutely nothing to show for it. So I was not really prepared to waste my life. I decided I've got to really do something. Mm. And for some reason, business became my option. Mm. But by law in South Africa at the time, you're not allowed as black South Africans to go into business. Mm. But then I said to myself, I'm not going to respect this unjust piece of law, legislation. If I get arrested, then let it be. And I decided I must go into business. Mm. And obviously everything else is history.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Herman Mashaba. He is one of South Africa's most successful and important and influential entrepreneurs. As we're about to find out, he founded in the mid-1980s a company that sold hair care products, a company called Black Like Me, and it eventually became spectacularly successful. And it has allowed Mr. Mashaba to go on to be a very important philanthropist and civic leader in South Africa. And he is visiting the campus of Carthage College today. He's in our studios today along with Carthage's own Dr. Art Sear. Mr. Mashaba, you were saying that at the time that you sold kind of different things and began selling hair products and began thinking this would be fun. And then at some point, you saw something which you realized would be an opportunity to perhaps begin, in a sense, selling to a different customer base, or that there was an opportunity there that other people were not seeing. What did you see around you in the South African public that was, in effect, a great opportunity that you seized?
Yeah, what happened is during the process of really selling as a commission sales rep, because while I was working, I saved money, got married, and bought myself a vehicle, and I became a commission sales rep selling different types of products. And eventually, I sold hair care products for one company in Johannesburg on a commission basis. And I sold for them for 19 months and discovered this minefield of an opportunity. Black women in South Africa wanted to be permed and really wanted something to really make them beautiful. And I said to myself, Herman, you're not going to really be selling these products for someone else for the rest of your lives when you can see this great opportunity.
But then, let me just interrupt for a moment. So when you began selling for another company, this is before you've created your own company, this was a white-owned company.
White-owned company.
And
because black South Africans are not allowed to go into business.
Right. And who were you selling these products to?
To just in our salons in South Africa, we're just mushrooming at every corner in the city centers, in every township, in every village, and selling for this white company on a commission basis. And I said to myself,
Were these salons for black people?
Yeah, for black people.
Okay.
Yeah,
but so it was a white owned company, but you're selling these products to salons.
Yeah.
And you're realizing then that some of these black women would like to own these products themselves.
Absolutely.
And perm their hair themselves at home rather than go to a salon.
And yeah, so that's really when I did not really obviously have the technical know-how to really make this product. But now, as I said earlier on, contact with white people in South Africa really very limited. I think at the age of 24, I took a hell of a chance to approach the white guy who used to work as a production manager for this company. a guy called Johan Grill. Actually, the owner of the business used to like me because I was his top sales man the 19 months I sold for him. And used to travel with him to different places, seeing clients and so forth. And one day talking to him, looking at business risks, and he brought a very interesting issue to my attention about being concerned that this Johan, who was the production manager, he's one obviously big risk. And why Johan was an entrepreneur who, but before he joined Thompson was the owner of the business, and they were family. Says this guy, as soon as he recovers financially, he's going to leave us. So he says, there's one thing that we need to do to really get, I've got to really make sure that I have someone to replace Johan, because I don't think he'll be there forever. And that really then presented an opportunity for me. And one day I decided to take a chance to approach Johan to say, look, Johan, I'm going to be leaving this business to go ahead and really set up my own business to really be in this industry. But and I don't know how to make that stuff. Joseph was one of the partners I've invited in the business. I said, Johan, Joseph and I can sell this product, and you're the best production guy. Let's go out and really do it on our own.
To actually produce the product.
Produce, yes. And fortunate enough, Johan bought into our dream. And he says, where do we get the funding? I said, Johan, leave that to me. And yeah, then we approached another black business guy who had was a very successful entrepreneur in one of the townships in Pretoria. Approached this guy to really give us the funding for the business. That was sometime in late 1984. And January of 1985, we started our business in a 200 square meter factory. What happened is during the apartheid era, the apartheid government has set up what they called black homelands. It's like Puputatso and Asiskai, where they were obviously displaying this to the world that blacks have got their own independent states. So they were obviously limited. There were opportunities for black businessmen to operate to some extent, as much as they were controlled at a bigger level, but we could manipulate. And Walter, the guy who gave us the funding, was really very clever to really work out the system. So managed to get us a premises, 200 square meter factory. And gave us the funding, and started producing. So
it was not what you were doing was not illegal.
No, it was not illegal. You needed to really understand the system to manipulate it.
Right.
Yeah. So, and that's exactly what we did. So we set up, because I couldn't set up a factory and a business in white South Africa. So then I went to the homeland. I went to one of the homelands because there, as a blacks to some extent, they could operate, you know. Mm. But those, obviously, the homelands were not the ideal environment because, I mean, that's areas that white government didn't really want. And obviously, they had to really have this homeland system to demonstrate to the world that, no, we don't really separate. We just want blacks to be in their own areas. So I took advantage of the system and set up my factory in one of the homelands called Puputatswana. And
right.
Got premises there and started operating in January of 1985.
Explain the name of your company. From the start, was it called Black Like Me?
Very interesting name because I did not really have enough money for marketing. And one of the days, actually took us a couple of weeks really debating on the name, because I said to the team, we need to really get a name that can attract the attention of the market. And one day, Walter came out with this name, Black Like Me, after trying so many names. And I really said, this is the name. And but then we said, guys, are we not going to attract the attention of government, thinking that we're another black consciousness or another black political party? But fortunate enough, I think perhaps because we had this white partner with us, an Afrikaner for that matter, we never really attracted the attention of the authorities. And But one thing we did is we attracted the attention of the market. Mm. The name really appealed to our people because the name Black Lakmi, and you look at my marketing campaigns from day one, was to really give a sense of pride to black women and men that were using our products. So we really used the slogans to really give them that sense of belonging, give them that dignity back. Mm. And so it was really very quite cheap to really market the product because the name, it was a kind of name that you could not easily ignore.
Right.
And everything else is history.
Yeah, it sure is. I want to give you a chance to mention something else about your story, namely that I think just before this happened, the founding of your company, you had married.
Yes.
You married fairly young, and I read...
That's the most important part of his success.
Well, it's significant. Today happens to be my wedding anniversary, so maybe that's why I want to take a second.
No.
But I remember, I don't remember if this is something I saw in an interview or in a portion of your book, but you talk about how you saw getting married as a stabilizing force in your life, and that you thought that would make some of these other accomplishments you hoped to achieve easier if your life had, in a sense, the stability of being married to a supportive partner and so on. Am I remembering that right?
Absolutely, very right, Derek. I think, you know, for me, to my wife, I look back, I've been married to her for 33 years. Uh-huh. For 33 years. And I got married at the age of 22. My wife was 20. And before actually even buying the car, I said to myself, I don't know who really gave me this blessing, this foresight to say, look, you know, business, you really require stability. So before you buy the car, to get married and stabilize so that, you know, you don't really have any reason to go and play with other boys as and when it's not necessary. So that's really what I did. Before buying the car, got married. And 2 months later, that's when I then bought a car. Then 2 months later, I then resigned from my normal work. And I look back at my life. My wife, when I started my cosmetic business in 1985, recruited her to come and really be our bookkeeper in the business. And but without any doubt, the role that she's played in my life, it's been tremendous, been profound. And I really, really thank God for having given me that blessing and the foresight to realize the importance of stability in one's life in a business environment.
So how rapidly...
Or any other environment.
Yeah, for that matter. Yeah, that's true. So how rapidly did Black Like Me take off? I mean, were there early years that were difficult? Or did it enjoy tremendous success almost from the very start?
From inception. Walter, the guy who gave us the money, and I got really quite expensive funding of my business. I got my funding from Walter at Prime Plus 10. Plus 25% shareholding the business. You know, it was very expensive. I mean, Alter was really taking a hell of a chance with two black guys and a white guy that he didn't know from nowhere. And says, guys, I'm happy to really beg you, but you know, unfortunately, the risks are high. And I understood, and I supported that. So he gave us 3 years to repay this money, and managed to repay this loan in 7 months.
Wow.
And wow. And I remember that on the last month when I went to Walter, because from day one we started repaying the loan. And 7 months managed to repay the entire loan. When I went to him to say, Mr. Dube, Walter Dube, I said, please, let's really work out how much we owe you. We'd like to really repay the loan. And by that time, the business was doing so well. He says, no, guys, you're crazy. Why repay me now? Obviously, I mean, if you're getting prime plus 10. And at the time in South Africa, prime was sitting at 21%.
Wow.
So you can imagine playing at the 30, you know.
Expensive
money.
So
it was very expensive, you know.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, he wasn't interested in getting his money. He tried to convince us not to repay.
Don't hurry.
You know, he says, don't worry. And I said, no, Alter, this is expensive. You're still a shareholder in the business. Yeah, so yeah, I paid back my money in that loan in 7 months, and managed within by late 80s, within 4 or 5 months, yes, managed to really build myself a huge 6,000 square meter factory,
wow,
state of the art, with best machinery. I did not owe anyone a cent for it. Huh. So that really demonstrated how successful the business was from inception. During difficult periods of our country's history, with state of emergencies, with townships burning, But we could really maneuver and really get our products all over the country, set up distributors all over the country, including in the neighboring countries. And, but unfortunately for me, 17th of November 1993, someone decided to touch my factory overnight. I had no physical structures. The factory burned. It's one of the difficult periods of my life. 17th of November 1993, at the eve of our democracy, when our political leadership were busy negotiating the transition to democracy, someone decided to take advantage of the stalemate and torch my factory overnight. Burned it to the ground. But fortunate enough, they underestimated my resolve in fighting when you put me in a corner. And within 2 weeks, managed to really buy my new factory. Now, at the time, as much as apartheid legislation was still in force, but then at the time, the country was now opening up. I managed now to really buy a factory in a proper industrial area in the so-called White South Africa, and I did not really have to really have someone doing it for me. And I bought my factory, but then it took me close to 2 years to really get back into production. And you lose market share you lose focus. But I survived. And culminating in 1997, I sold 75% of my business to Colgate-Palmolive. Excited with the prospects of selling my business to this successful American company. And I thought Colgate is going to help me take my business globally. And that's really what Colgate and I wanted to do. But for some reason, 18 months down the line, my business just refused to be part of this global success. Just refused. And we started suffering sales, losing money. And I announced to Colgate to really buy the 25%. And I had great corporate advices. And Colgate was also happy to sell me the business back.
So you got it back then?
Yeah, August 1999, I took back the business 100%. And it was another great achievement in my life. But then you're taking a business that tough, and now we're right in the middle of our democracy in South Africa. But I managed to really turn things around. It has really been a very interesting but really challenging journey. I think I would not really want to replace that life with anything else.
We're speaking with Herman Mashaba, a very successful entrepreneur in South Africa, the author of a couple of different books, most recently Capitalist Crusader, Fighting Poverty Through Economic Growth. He is speaking at Carthage College today, speaking up in Milwaukee this evening. Mr. Mashaba, before we talk about South Africa today, I wonder if you could help us, from your perspective, understand the way in which South Africa was transformed with the end of apartheid. As someone who lived there, lived through apartheid, and then saw so many of those old barriers, by no means all of them, we shouldn't probably overstate the transformation of South Africa. And on the other hand, there are many ways in which, of course, that your country was radically reshaped in astounding ways. First of all, when it happened, did you expect it to happen? I mean, did it happen sooner than you, or was it a long-awaited goal that finally it's here? And when the change occurred, did it change in the ways that you expected?
I think, without any doubt, the independence of our country took us by surprise, because we grew up not really be aware that one day we'll see independence. And we knew that, we suspect that if one day it would come, it'll come through a violence transition. And that was really something that was scary. But then we had no option. That's the reason why at the age of 20, I abandoned my education, and I wanted to really be one of those fighters. You know, as much as we knew the final outcome of a violent transition is not good, but what options did we have? And I actually look back in history, what really triggered the independence of our country was the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union. That probably really made life easy for the National Party government to realize that they've got to really move on. They had no Western support because obviously during the Cold War, before the collapse, the Western powers, United States and Great Britain, you remember quite well, they used to be blocking every attempt by the United Nations to impose sanctions and take drastic measures against South Africa because they were obviously concerned about the communist threat. So as soon as the Berlin Wall collapsed and the Soviet Union also collapsing, unfortunately, South Africa lost friends. All of a sudden, United States and Britain were no longer on their side. They were on their own. And they just could not really maintain that system, that evil system. And we were taken by surprise on the 2nd of February, 1990, De Klerk in the opening of Parliament announced the release of Nelson Mandela and the unbanning of political parties. I mean, took to the whole world by surprise. And that's really when, obviously, tough discussion negotiations really started to formulate a new country, a new dispensation, and culminating with the elections in 1994. And South Africa was really so blessed with the leadership of Nelson Mandela. I mean, it was a remarkable human being. I mean, you can imagine, I don't know if you've really read or know about his life, how he suffered all his life for mankind. And he comes out and really talk about reconciliation, talk about creating this rainbow nation, and really committed to that process. I mean, I was really privileged also to really have some interactions with him before and after when he was the leader of the country. And yes, all of a sudden, all of us were excited with this new prospect of really building this great nation of South Africans, a great rainbow nation, which we sold to the whole world, culminating in 1996 with adoption of our new constitution, which has really been hailed as the most progressive constitution in the world. And so you can imagine the excitement. And Mandela, because of age, only served one term, 5-year term, and the country was taken over by Thabo Mbeki, who in the first term of his presidency was also another great leader, started coming out with what he called the African Renaissance, rebirth of the African continent, encouraging to really have democratic principle, democratic government, accountable government. And I think some of us at the time, prominent South Africans, really gave him the support, excited with this prospect of South Africa playing a role in ensuring that Africa can one day really become a prosperous, proud continent. For some reason, in his second term, I don't really know what happened with the situation in Zimbabwe. It started developing with taking over of white farms, and really lots of Zimbabweans leaving the country. A lot of atrocities committed by the government. But for some reason, Thabo Mbeki adopted this diplomatic silence, not really coming out against this. And that's really what happened. And now today, 21 years into our democracy, the current government, to some extent, being ruled by what would they call the Tripartite Alliance, dominated by the so-called communist and the labor organizations, really very powerful. They've really, labor and the Communist Party have literally taken over our government. And that's why some of us are concerned, and that's the reason why I've now written this book, to really appeal to South Africans. Firstly, to really be active citizens, because we have this constitution that guarantees us our individual freedoms. So really saying to South Africans, please, let us not be apathetic. Let us really take the reins and really be proactive so that the politicians can respect us as the bosses. because I think us as the voters are the bosses. And, and really asking South Africa to really pursue free market economy. And at the same time, actually stop this racist policies where obviously the government is trying to address the ills of the past by coming out with racist policies that favors black people. And I'm saying we've been trying this for the last 20 years. Look at the devastating effects. We cannot. I don't want to live in a society where my country is divided against along racial lines. I'm really appealing to South Africa to say the only way this country is going to really make it, we need the leadership that can really create that rainbow nation that Mandela wanted. So that's really where we are right now, that we're fighting to ensure that I think we can really build us as that rainbow nation that Mandela wanted to create.
The presence of this communist ideology in so much of the government now, how much does that reflect the sentiments of the overall population pulling away from capitalism and shifting towards more socialist models, and where is that coming from? I mean, what is it? Some kind of a fear or bitterness, or what is it that is driving some people towards those ideologies?
I think, you know, unfortunately, the voters, the particularly poor voters, the government is obviously really making them dependent on them. I mean, we're a country of, what, 50 million South Africans? We today sit with over 16 million people on social welfare.
So, wow.
Yeah, no, we sit with one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. We sit with one of the highest youth unemployment rates in the world. And obviously, government pushes the social programs to ensure that poor people depend on government. They must see government as the best savior. So we sit with that situation that when you're not really providing the best education to people and you keep on really pumping the billions of dollars behind social programs, that system that is not sustainable. You know, we sit with the economy that's not really growing. I mean, 2 weeks ago, we the latest GDP numbers, our economy shrunk by 1.3%. You know, so these are real scary stats. And at the same time, you have the government with this massive social welfare system. How are you going to maintain this? So if South Africa does not really do something about it, our country will collapse. Obviously, not going to collapse overnight because we're fortunate enough we've got a very strong economy. And I'm personally very positive that South Africans will wake up to this reality to ensure that we don't really pursue such devastating policies on a long-term basis.
It really doesn't seem so much like old-time communism as opportunism. Mm-hmm. An ideology that helps support a very corrupt clique that's profiting personally at the top.
Absolutely.
It really seems like universal corruption rather than any particular ideology.
Well, you are certainly spreading the word of freedom and free markets and the idea of people embracing opportunity and taking responsibility and building good lives for themselves through this book you've just written, Capitalist Crusader, and through the speaking that you do all over your country and in other places as well, and indeed on the campus of Carthage. Dr. Sir, remind our listeners of when Mr. Mashaba is speaking today.
He'll be meeting mostly with classroom groups on campus in our Todd Ware Center at 9:15 and 1:35. If people are really interested in attending, that certainly we would welcome them calling the college on that. We're very happy that he's able to do this media work here. We have steady and in many ways growing involvement internationally. President Greg Woodward, as you know, has been spearheading that. Tom Clawson, our graduate and the namesake of our Clawson Center, had a strong interest in Africa, which he developed when he was leading the World Bank back in the 1980s. Of the different projects that we've developed at our center, some have been easier to develop than others. I'm determined to steadily work with others at the college to expand our involvement in Africa. We have had social work students doing field work in Ghana. Ebola slowed that down, but that's now fading, and they will be back. Your colleague, Peter Denis, in music, has taken groups there. There's all kinds of individual activity. and Herman Mashaba's visit, given the importance and also great visibility of the visit, especially on your program, I think will serve as a useful, I'm sure will serve as a useful catalyst to provide further energy and further integration to these efforts.
Very good. Herman Mashaba, a great honor to meet you, to hear more about your really inspiring personal story. And we wish you only the very best in all that you do in the future on behalf of your beautiful country.
No, thank you very much for this really great opportunity and really great opportunity to really get an opportunity to interact with Americans, because they also really played a key role in the liberation of our country. I'm sure you know very well the role that Americans played. Ordinary citizens of this country played a role in ensuring that the apartheid system collapses. And I think for us as South Africans, really grateful for the role that America played.
Herman Mashaba, thank you again so much for being here. Very best wishes to you and safe travels back home.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I speak with two young men from Boston who helped create one of the most successful apparel companies here in America, Life is Good, and a company which also exists to do as much good as they can in the world. And we'll be talking with them and about the book which they have co-written. And on Wednesday, a look at the importance of copyright law as we talk to two people from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, including Lisa Kornetsky, a good friend of the morning show from the theater department. They have an event coming up at UW-Parkside towards the end of the month designed to help the public understand and appreciate the importance of copyright protection for all of us. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website.